All right. The Gospel of Mark. What I want to do right here, pretty much today, and maybe throughout the rest of this week, we'll only make it through the first three verses probably this week and next week, because we're going to be dealing with a lot of issues surrounding the Gospel of Mark, and the first three verses really set up the entire Gospel. And so we're really going to take time to dig deep into the first three verses so that we can be prepared for what we're going to be reading in the next 16 chapters. Okay? How much overlap is there between Mark and Matthew? I've said it like four times. 92%. That could be a good test question. You know what I mean? That may not come straight out of the text. But man, if I've repeated it four times, write it down. Okay? 92% overlap of the Gospel of Mark. There is a 48.5%, this is not a good test question, but it's still good information. 48.5% of Mark is in Luke. So almost half of Luke parallels the Gospel of Mark. And between Matthew and Luke combined, 95% of Mark can be reconstructed from those two Gospels. Which leaves really only 5% of Mark is unique to Mark. So Mark, which we're not going to get into this too much. If you want to get into this in more detail, you can go into the intro to the Gospels, New Testament intro class. But this leads a lot of people to understand that there's probably some borrowing from somewhere when it comes to the Synoptic Gospels especially. Everybody understand what I mean when I say Synoptic Gospels? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Those three are called Synoptics. John gets left out in the cold unnecessarily, in my opinion. But I understand. Because there's so much overlap in the first three Gospels, those are usually grouped together, and they try to wrestle with how many sources. Is there two sources? Is there four sources? We're not going to get into that very much, because it doesn't really impact the interpretation of Mark, from my understanding. Although it could. But we're not going to deal with it. There are the major divisions of the Gospel of Mark, if I was going to say big picture outline. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 15 is the prologue. That just is kind of getting us going. We're just trying to lay down a foundation so we can move. Then what you have in 1:16 through 10:52 is Jesus' Galilean ministry. That's where he's traveling around, and we spend about 3 years in those 10 chapters. Chapter 11, 1 through 16, 8. Chapter 11, 1 through 16, 8. So those 6-7 chapters, those are 1 week. And those are in the either going to or in the city of Jerusalem. And those are the big three major divisions. The prologue, 1:1 through 15. Part 1, the Galilean ministry, 1:16 through 10:52. And then you have Jesus in Jerusalem for that 1 week in 11:1 through 16:8, part 3. Major divisions, so you can kind of see where he's moving. And that actually plays into some of the key characteristics. What is the most favorite word of the gospel writer known as Mark? What is his favorite word?
Immediately.
Euthus in the Greek, and you'll see that everywhere. As a matter of fact, euthus is used 42 times in the Gospel of Mark, 36 times in the first 10 chapters. 36 times in the first 10 chapters. Immediately Jesus went over here, and then immediately he went over here, and then immediately he went over here, and then immediately. And what he's doing is he's driving us. See, some people will say, oh, Mark's in a hurry. He's just in a hurry. He's just trying to get down as much as he can, just kind of a Cliff Notes version of the gospel. That's not really true. Because whenever you actually get into the detail of the stories, you find that Mark actually gives us more detailed accounts than what you find in Matthew and Luke a lot of the time. It's just he's rapidly moving from one event to another because he's not in a hurry. He's driving towards a purpose. And the purpose comes in chapters 11 through 16. And that's why you only find 6 occurrences of the word euthus in chapters 11 through 16. And what is chapters 11 through 16? You've already written it in your notes. We've already said it once this morning. It's what? It's the last week. One whole week. For 6 to 7 chapters. See, Mark's not in a hurry when he's telling us Jesus' gospel. He's driving to his main point. Jerusalem. That's his point. And once he gets there in chapter 11, he says, now let's slow the pace down and let's really start looking at everything that we're interacting with in this last week because it's huge. If you will notice, and I'm going to just tease you with this right now, I hope it doesn't destroy your faith, tease you, but just tease you in the sense that maybe you'll come back tomorrow. I do think the gospel ends in verse 8. Even though our Bibles have 9 through 20 at the end, I believe it ends in verse 8. Now, let's flip there really quick so that we don't get freaked out, although I am going to save the full explanation of this for the very last lecture of the class. I'll tease you with one of the first ones, and then we'll explain it in the last ones. You can, by the way, do your paper over this issue. I would allow somebody to do that. Where the Gospel of Mark ends. I would let somebody do their paper over that issue. Actually, Mark Scott allowed me to do that when I was in this class, so that's why my heart's there. Anyway, what do you notice, though, in most of your, unless you have a KJV, what do you notice at the end of verse 8? What does it say? Anybody? Just yell it out. The earliest manuscripts, and I would also say the earliest and best, because there are manuscripts, that all manuscripts are not created equal. We have some that are more dependable than others. The earliest and best manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16, 9 through 20. That actually is oversimplifying the issue. Because Mark chapter 16, 9 through 20 isn't even the only ending that we have of Mark's gospel. After verse 8. Once you hit after verse 8, you have three different options, sometimes in varying levels. Now, should this rattle your faith? Oh man, we lost 12 verses of the Bible. What's going on? Relax. Number one, the resurrection already happened in verses 1 through 8 of 16. We didn't lose that, okay? Number two, I actually appreciate that we're honest about this whenever our manuscripts are different than what is the tradition. I like that. Because we're not holding anything back. We're not pulling any punches. We're saying this is where we're at on our document evidence. And whenever you compare our document evidence to others, there's nothing to worry about at all. We're very secure. We're desiring scientific precision where it doesn't need to be. Okay? But we'll get there and I'll alleviate that tension even more later. Right now, trust this. Nothing has changed about the truth of Jesus Christ because we lose those 12 verses. But if you want to keep them because that makes you feel good, that's fine. Keep them. Okay? You're not, because it's not like they teach heresy. Technically, they do teach handling of snakes. It does. 9 through 20. For the believers will even be able to handle poisonous snakes and it will not hurt them. And that's why you find people down in the backwoods of Arkansas grabbing snakes. It's true, because they really like these 12 verses. They don't really like the ramifications of it, especially when they are bitten. I don't even know why I went on that tangent. Doesn't matter. One of the other key characteristics of the Gospel of Mark is known as the Messianic Secret. That phrase was coined by a guy by the name of Red, but it's spelled W-R-E-D-E, at the end of the 19th century. Very important for the study of the historical Jesus, because his book, William Red's book on the Messianic Secret, was one of the studies that concluded or heavily damaged the first quest for the historical Jesus. Because what he shows is that there is a theological movement in the Gospel of Mark that revolves around this messianic secret thing. Have you heard about this with the Gospel of Mark? It's weird because it is in the other Gospels, but Mark really seems to be using it for a key purpose. You'll find it in Mark chapter 1, 43 through 45. Jesus heals a man with leprosy, and what does he tell him? He heals him, and what does he say? Don't tell anyone. Matter of fact, it says he sternly warns him, which even could be translated with the feeling of rebuke. He rebukes him and says, do not tell anyone. And what does the man with leprosy do? He goes and tells. Are you allowed to disobey Jesus if you're telling who he is to everybody? That's kind of a weird theological idea. I can't help but tell people who he is, but he told you not to. Oh. Well, we'll talk about what I think's happening with Messianic Secret the very last day of class. Yeah, that's right. Whenever we deal with it throughout the semester, I'll say, huh, there's some options here. We're not going to deal with it now. The very last day of class, so don't miss it. Mark 7:36, Jesus heals a man that's deaf and mute and then commands him, oh yeah, don't tell anyone. Matter of fact, even after Peter gives the great confession, the thing that Jesus follows it up with is, Peter, don't tell anyone. And Peter obeys. Whoops. That's weird. Yeah, and one of the only times that Peter closes his mouth when maybe he should have opened it. Anyway, the reason for the phenomenon, like I said, we're not going to talk about it till the last day of class. What I want to ask, though, right off the bat is, what is missing at the very beginning of the Gospel of Mark that is not like any of the other three Gospels? What's missing? A genealogy, right? Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And for the next 16 verses, what does he do? This guy who is the father of this guy, and this guy who's the son of this guy, and this guy who's the son of this. That's what he does the whole time, right? The boring genealogy of Matthew. Luke doesn't have it right off the bat. Luke has it in which chapter, do you know? Have you taken Luke yet with Griff? If so, I'll tell on you. Luke chapter, cheat if you need to. Three! Luke chapter 3. Now, his genealogy seems to be somewhat different than Matthew's genealogy, because where does Luke take us all the way back to? Adam. He doesn't just go to Abraham and move forward from the promise. He says, actually, let's go all the way back to the beginning. And he goes all the way back to Adam. Then, where is John's genealogy? Chapter 1, verses. Yeah, 1 and following. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the beginning was the Word. What's he doing? He's saying, I want to give you the divine genealogy of the Logos. In verse 14, he says, the Logos, which took on flesh and pitched his tent among us. So what you have, genealogies are very important when it comes to Gospels, because you can look at the genealogies and understand what the main purpose of the book is. The main purpose of Matthew's genealogy. Matthew's genealogy revolves around three segments. Verses 2 through 6, the first half, talked about the establishment of the kingdom of God, because it ends with King David. Verses, the last half of verse 6 through 11, ends with the exile in Babylon. So the kingdom that was established in the first six verses is lost in the next six verses. And then, in verses 12 through 16, where does he end? And Joseph, who is married to Mary, who gave birth to a son by the name of Jesus, who is called Christ. So what you have in Matthew's Gospel, you have the kingdom established, the kingdom lost, and the kingdom restored. What do you think Matthew's purpose is for his Gospel? Kingdom! It's going to surround kingdom. Why? The genealogy tells me so. Now look at Luke's Gospel. Where does he take us back to? Adam. What do you think the purpose of Luke's Gospel is to emphasize? He is a man. Which, you know what's really interesting is whenever you're actually studying the first and the second centuries, the heresies that are going around it, the primary heresy that they were trying to fight, the Christians were trying to fight, was not that Jesus was truly a God, but that he really was a man. Because they revered him so much that they said, he has transcended this evil material world and he must only have been a God. And that's why you have in 1 John saying, no, he was a man. He really was a man. But he was also a God. Which is fascinating because we flip that now. Oh no, we know he was a man. He was a historical Jesus. But the Jesus of faith, well, that's just to oppress people. Thanks, Dan Brown. But the genealogy of Luke tells us, hey, I'm going to emphasize something, the humanity of Jesus. And what he also does by emphasizing the humanity of Jesus is he also is tracing the way in which Jesus affected or interacted with outcasts of humanity. And so the first words of Jesus' public ministry in Luke's Gospels in Luke 4, where Jesus comes on the scene, he says, I have come to preach the good news to the poor. And Luke's Sermon on the Mount in Luke 6, he says, blessed are the poor. He doesn't say poor in spirit like Matthew. Blessed are the poor. He doesn't say blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. He says blessed are those that hunger and thirst. Why? Because Luke's Gospel is focusing on not just the humanity of Jesus, but humanity as a whole, the outcast that Jesus brought in because of who he is. Am I suggesting that Luke doesn't say anything about the divinity of Jesus? No. Just because it's their main point doesn't mean it's their only point. Okay? The genealogies, though, give us a lens with which we read. John's gospel, one of the reasons why historical Jesus movement wants to kick it out of the conversation is because his genealogy tells us his key point is to show the divinity of Jesus. In the beginning was the Word, was with God. The Word was God. As a matter of fact, even James Dunn, who does this Christology in the making, the development of when Jesus became a God, says clearly in John's gospel, Jesus is a God. That's why we can't add it into the evidence. Oh, well, that's convenient. Because we can lop off whatever we want, whenever we want. Point is, genealogies tell us something about how to read the book. So what do we do when there is no genealogy? There's a couple of reasons why there may not be a genealogy, and I say couple in the sense of two, reasons why that I can see, and there may be more, this is just where my dense mind is able to grab a hold of, is these two. One, Mark may not have a genealogy because he's in just such a big hurry he forgot to write it. It's just not important to him. I don't have time for genealogy. I need to get moving. So Peter bursts, or John the Baptist bursts on the scene. We need to talk about John the Baptist, but we'll only give him like five verses. Then Jesus is baptized. The wilderness, even though Matthew gives it 11, 12 verses, we're going to give it like a verse in Mark's gospel because I don't have time. I need to get moving. Euthus immediately. That is one option. However, for a Jew, even though John Mark wasn't a Jew, we'll talk about later how he was writing. His primary source was one of the key Jewish leaders. For a Jew, genealogies were not something that you just skip over because you don't have time. Genealogies in the Jewish mind was the way in which God had orchestrated all the events of history to bring about His purposes. And if you think about all the different events in your life right now that actually were orchestrated to work to get you to sit where you're sitting right now, the fact you're even here could be called by some a miracle. Right? Let me just give you a little background about me. Because the fact I'm even standing up here almost didn't happen. My parents, my mom accidentally got impregnated by my dad when they were dating for only 1 month. 1 month. And she didn't even tell my dad whenever she was pregnant. Because they had already broken up and were dating other people. So my mom was going one Saturday morning to get an abortion of my older brother. And her friend talked her into telling my dad. She told my dad, don't get rid of the baby. We're getting married and we're having this kid. And they did. And they've been together for almost 30 years. But if she would have had that abortion, my brother wouldn't have been there, and more than likely I wouldn't either. Almost didn't happen. My genealogy tells you more than just names. It's the way in which God has moved throughout history to bring about His purposes. I do believe Acts 17 is right. Whenever Paul's talking to the Athenians, and he says, God has put each humanity, each person, in the exact place at the exact time so that we could reach out and touch God because He's revealing Himself to us in that context. I believe that with all that's in me. And genealogies are what show us that. The purposes of God had to go through Rahab, had to go through Ruth, had to go through ridiculous amounts of outcasts. Sorry, ladies, but they were considered outcasts. Genealogy shows the miracle of God to bring about His purposes against all probabilities. Because if one thing would have shifted, if Rahab wouldn't have lied, what would have happened? Isn't that weird? Rahab's in the Faith Hall of Fame in Hebrews 11 because she lied. Awesome. But if she hadn't, what would that have done to the genealogy? You see, genealogies aren't something that Jews just zip past. Because it actually shows the hand of God moving. And that's something that they were very intrigued by. Because what it shows is their story. They're celebrating the fact that they're even here because of what God has done with all these different people. And yet Mark doesn't have a genealogy. I don't think it was because Mark was just in a hurry. I think it's because of Mark's purpose. The second reason why a genealogy is so important to a Jew is not just because of the way in which God moved, but because genealogy is not for just for Jews, but also for all the ancient people. Genealogies were legal documents that revealed what your legal rights were to a particular inheritance. You would use a genealogy to show what you rightfully owned, inheritance-wise. Now, who in the ancient world, if that was one of the key purposes, like for example, land, to prove that this was your land, you would show your genealogy of the people that had owned this land and shown that you stand in that genealogy. Who in the ancient world would a genealogy, according to that, not be really significant for? Slaves. Why? They don't own anything. They're not the ones that own the land. They're the ones that work the land for the owner. What do they have to pass down to their kids that we want to make sure we have a genealogy so we can figure out what we own? They don't have anything. They're barely lucky to survive, more or less provide an inheritance. What could that possibly be saying then for the Gospel of Mark? What is his primary point? If Jesus doesn't have a genealogy, what's his primary point? What? Jesus is a slave. Standing at the heart, right? Remember I told you the divisions of the book. The second major division in 11:1 ends with 10:45 through 52. And what does Mark 10:45 say, Ozark Christian College students? For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life as a ransom for many. Right in the heart of the Gospel of Mark stands this passage that as soon as you hear it, it harkens back to the fact that we didn't even have a genealogy. Because in the heart of it, it says, Jesus the King, because that will be a major motif as well, the kingness of Jesus. But He's not a king like your kings. This King didn't come to be served. He came to serve. And to give His life as a ransom for many. I use that text almost every single marriage or wedding ceremony that I do. Every one of them. And I basically do a very Jewish thing. I do a how much more. You're coming to this marriage ceremony and Jesus came to this earth. And He didn't come to be served. He came to serve. And if you come to this marriage with that particular attitude, that you're not coming to this marriage to be served, but to serve, and to give your life up for the person that you're wedding, your marriage is going to be fine. One of the major breakdowns of marriages or relationships is communication and selfishness. And some of you aren't incompatible with people. Some of you are just too selfish to be in a relationship. And that's just the reality. You're just too self-absorbed. And that's one of the reasons why you can't have any relationship to be sustained. You just don't get it. And if you can't get it whenever you're married to a woman or to a man, oh, when you have children, you're going to be a mess. Or you'll at least make them a mess. Because selfishness has no place, not only in a marriage relationship, but even in a father-son relationship or a mother-daughter relationship. Selfishness is what destroys community. Selfishness is what destroys relationships. And Jesus comes and He says, I'm going to restore our relationships, not by being a king that lords it over you, but by being a king that serves. That's what I do. How? By laying my life down as a ransom for many. It's not an accident then whenever Paul starts talking about relationships, he says, husbands, love your wives the way that Christ loved the church. How did Christ love the church? He laid His life down for it. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life as a ransom for many. That's the heartbeat of the Gospel of Mark. Also, one of the other key aspects of the Gospel of Mark... Didn't turn the page. Any questions about that before we start moving on to much more interesting things like authorship and dating? Any questions about that? Gospel of Mark is one of those gospels, I'll say this. Because of its emphasis on servant, being a servant, and its emphasis on discipleship, if you read the Gospel of Mark and it doesn't impact or change your life, a couple of things are happening. Either number one, you're too academic and you need a good kick in the pants for you to wake up and realize why you're studying what you're studying. Or number two, you don't have a pulse. You hear my heart in that? I guess number three, I could add a three. Maybe you just don't know who Jesus is. But I'm assuming if you're here, you do. Okay? So, yeah. Okay. Any other things, questions, reflections, thoughts? Going once, gone. Most books, well, no. That's not accurate. Some books of the New Testament or even the Old Testament, the issues of authorship and dating don't necessarily impact the interpretation heavily. Can they? Yes. Otherwise, my New Testament introduction class would be unnecessary. They do in some levels. But some books, for example, Hebrews. We don't really know who wrote the book of Hebrews. We don't really know. It could have been Paul, maybe. I doubt it. Apollos is probably the best guess, but even that's a stretch. Some people will be like, oh, it's Priscilla. But that's just because they're trying to get a woman to write a book in the Bible. And I think that's a noble cause, but again, that's a stretch at best. We don't really know. And that doesn't particularly impact our understanding of the book of Hebrews, because we are so overwhelmed with the Old Testament connections with the New Testament and the way in which God is moving throughout His promises of the Old Testament, fulfilling them in Jesus, that we don't really care about the authorship issue when it comes to Hebrews. The Gospel of Mark is not like that. The authorship issue and the dating issue really impact our interpretation of it. What it does in particular, it's not that if you don't know these or get these that you're going to mess up the whole book. But if you have a date and an author in mind, it adds a flavor and a color that actually allows you to step into the book instead of merely having it be a document. And so we are going to spend some time talking about these issues. I find this particular study of Mark quite fascinating because of the impact that it has on the way we read the rest of the book. So let me see. Gospel of Mark's not like that. Disclaimer. I'm not going to go. Oh, yeah. I do need to put this disclaimer in. Sometimes in big, bold letters, I put disclaimers so that I remember to say this. I'm not going to go through every option for the dating of the Gospel of Mark. Why? That's not the purpose of this class. I'm going to tell you my opinion. You can disagree with it, and that's fine. And you can look at the other options and say, that one's clearly better and awesome. But this is the one that I'm going to do, and I'm just going to tell you the arguments, and we're going to move on. Okay? Okay. The external evidence for the author of Mark. External. Whenever you are looking at anything when it comes to authorship or dating, you always look at external evidence and internal evidence. What would external evidence contain? What would that be about? It's a 200-level class. I'm assuming Acts helped teach you this. What?
Evidence outside of Scripture?
Yes, outside of, which would include? Church fathers? What?
Historians.
Yeah, other historians that are closer to the time in which the book was written. They can even say, you know what, like for example, Eusebius is a good source, even though he's writing in the 4th, 5th century, because he's saying, hey, Papias of Hierapolis told us that this is who the book was written by, which that's actually what happens with the Gospel of Mark. External evidence. So let's read Eusebius, Ecclesiastical History 3.39.14-17. And Eusebius here is citing Papias, who is the bishop of Hierapolis, who lived around 60 to 130. So he's kind of close to when the gospel was written. Okay? 60 to 130. Let that sink in. 60 to 130. Okay? Okay. This actually is really interesting what he says. Listen to how the book, not only just who the author is, but how the author wrote the book. He says, Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately, though not indeed in order. Whoa, did you hear that? One of the things we assume about every gospel is that it happens in this sequence. Papias says, well, he wrote it down, but it wasn't in the order necessarily that it happened. What would be the purpose then of writing down the book if it wasn't in the exact order? Sometimes, even though our scientific minds, our modernistic tendencies don't allow this or want it to be, there are bigger issues than chronology for the gospel writers. You hear me on that? Sometimes the theological point they're trying to make is more important than the scientific one we wish they made. Okay? Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately, though not indeed in order, whatsoever he remembered of the things done or said by Christ. For he neither heard the Lord nor followed him. But afterward, as I said, he followed Peter, who adapted his teaching to the needs of his hearers, but with no intention... Did you hear that real quick, preachers, by the way? What did Peter do? He adapted what now? The teachings of Jesus for what purpose? Depending on his hearers. It's kind of like if you're preaching a junior high camp, you don't preach the same sermon that you preached at a senior citizens retreat. Doesn't make any sense. Trust me, they probably won't translate very well. But I could tell, I could do the exact same sermon, I could just recraft it. And Peter did that. Oh, you're squeaking on me. Peter, who adapted his teaching to the needs of his hearers, but with no intention of giving a connected account of the Lord's discourses. Do you hear what he's describing here? He's saying you got to understand how to read the book. So that Mark committed no error while he thus wrote some things as he remembered them. For he was careful of one thing, not to omit any of the things which he had heard, and not to state any of them falsely. In other words, we may need to reinterpret our rules or set of rules of how we identify accuracy with the gospel accounts. Why? Because Hierapolis in the first century said so. He may know something about why this was written. There's something that C.S. Lewis calls chronological snobbery, where 2,000 years later we will look back and say, well, they did it like morons. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's just you're so far removed that you don't understand why they're doing it, but what they did wasn't unnecessary, was even wrong. It's just different than the way you would have done it. Doesn't make you better or right. Makes you different. That is a different way of looking at this, okay? You following me? Question? Ecclesiastical Histories, or 3.39.14 through 17. And he's citing Papias. So, what we have is, in fact, there's no dissenting voice on the identity of the Gospel of Mark. There are a couple of other references of people that talk about the authorship of Mark externally. I can give you those real quick. Irenaeus, in Adversus Heresies, or Against Heresies, 2.1.2. He's writing in AD 180. And he says, yes, it was Mark that wrote the Gospel of Mark. So does Tertullian in Against Marcion 4.5. And so does Origen on his commentary on Matthew, which is interesting that he's talking about Mark. And he was writing in the early 3rd century. So you have multiple voices, and all of them agree that Mark wrote Mark. Good! That makes it easy. You don't have to rename the title. But I want you to look at the Papias quote, or the quote by Eusebius of Papias, and notice, where does Mark get his information for the gospel? Peter. John Mark. Oops, I said too much. Mark sits at the feet of Peter while Peter is preaching to multiple audiences, and he's just taking notes. Matter of fact, as the story is totally reconstructed from the other documents, what happens is this. Peter is preaching in Rome, and Mark's just taking notes because he just couldn't get enough. And the people of Rome, the Christians, say, please, will you please write this into a book so that we can have it? Because Peter, when you die, what are we going to do? How are we going to totally remember these stories? And so Mark goes to Peter, and he says, are you okay with this? And Peter says, yeah, go ahead and do it. And then came the Gospel of Mark. Where's the information coming from then? More from Mark than Mark's perspective. It's coming from Peter's, which will distinctly impact the way we look and read some of the texts, especially when Peter surfaces. Because man, there's moments where you can just picture Peter preaching. For example, after the Great Confession. And Jesus says, for surely the Son of Man will be betrayed and will be killed, crucified even. And Peter in his sermon says, and then I pulled him aside And I rebuked him. I rebuked him. Or whenever Peter is reliving the night of Jesus' betrayal, and he says, this little girl, stinking little girl, kept coming back, and no matter where I went, she was there. She kept saying, aren't you the one that followed the Galilean? No, surely not I. And then that crow of the rooster. Peter is the one telling this story. As Mark's writing it down, you can hear Peter's emotion coming out in it. The author of the book does matter. Believe it or not. We have 1 minute, so let's do internal evidence. No. Yeah. It's not internal evidence, though, within the Gospel of Mark, because he does not put himself in there except for possibly one place, and we'll talk about that when we're in the Garden of Gethsemane. But he never writes his name. However, if this is Mark, and the early church fathers do identify what I was slipping, and it is John Mark, that adds another element to this picture of the author, doesn't it? Because John Mark is found throughout the Bible in several key places. The first one I'm going to point to is his spiritual family. Peter, in 1 Peter 5:13, describes John Mark as my son. Why? Because it is very likely that John Mark was a convert of Peter's. So even in our gospel, even in our New Testament, we have a connection of Peter and John Mark that the external evidence affirms. 1 Peter 5:13 says, my son, John Mark. You also have in Acts 12:12, we know that John Mark had a mom, and her mom owned a house that all the Christians were staying in that were praying whenever Peter was imprisoned. And Peter goes back to where? The house of John Mark. Why? Because that's his convert. That's his spiritual family. And you also have Barnabas in Colossians 4:10. We know that he was Barnabas's what? Sorry. Cousin. So John Mark has some pretty big connections in the spiritual realm, doesn't he? Even the familial, the blood not only of Jesus, but of heritage. He's related to Barnabas, who happens to be the one that accompanies Paul. And Peter considered him his spiritual son. It is also possible that it was his house where the Lord's Supper happened, as well as the upper room in Acts chapters 1 and 2. Very possible. We'll fill the rest in about John Mark tomorrow, and then we'll go to the issue of dating, which is crazy and fun. Love you guys. See you tomorrow.